Do you want to stay over here? Oh, here we go. Here we go. Yeah. So, this is the case. And then the laser is one of those.
All right, so hi everyone. First of all, let me thank Peter and the organizers of this pretty awesome conference that I hadn't gotten a chance to know about yet. My name is Philip Rolla. I'm an ICU doc up in an urban community hospital in Montreal. I do a fair bit of phoned, that's my Twitter handle, and my blog, where you can see all kinds of nonsense. And one of my important disclosures, I really dislike recipe-based medicine. So I think this, unfortunately, I don't think you'll come away from this talk with these like nice therapeutic, you know, direct applications, but it's almost gonna be more of a philosophical point of care ultrasound talk. I don't have any conflicts of interest in this talk for sure. So the IVC, that's what I'm gonna talk about today. The IVC is a little bit like fashion. It's come in and out. It was really popular a decade ago. And then now, all of a sudden, there are a lot of feelings like, oh no, don't buy into the IVC. It doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to argue a bit of a different point about this. First of all, I'm going to go back a little bit to math class. And I think everyone's, can I get a show of hands for people who do look at the IVC or who have looked at the IVC? Okay, so a pretty good amount. And I think, can I get a show of hands of people who measure it a couple centimeters below the diaphragm in M mode or in a diameter way? Would that be most of the people? Maybe not. All right, good, good, good. So I think if we talk about physiology of the IVC, what we're looking at is volumetric changes with respiration or, you know, along with your normal cardiac cycle. And so I think our math, you know, junior high school professors would have probably failed us all if we tried to convince them that we could use a diameter measurement of a non-cylindrical structure to assess its volume. I think it would have said, listen, Tommy, Johnny, whatever, that's not gonna fly in my class. But that's what we do in medicine. We've determined that a couple centimeters below the diaphragm, we can reliably measure a diameter of an IVC and, you know, use that as a clinical basis. So that's why I think a lot of the evidence that's out there just hasn't really panned out. Because we're not, one, necessarily measuring it the right way. So how do I think we should do it? And you know, a few other people you might see. So I think you should mainly do a short axis view from your right atrium to your subhepatic IVC, essentially trying to get a global view of your IVC. You should eyeball it for size and variation. And I think there's plenty of evidence that an MD brain can do that well, because don't we do it for LVEFs all the time? And hasn't that been demonstrated to be pretty much as good as Simpson's disc in any other ways that we can measure EF? So I think we can do it. And I think we should classify relatively broadly in an empty, mid-size, full, maybe even toss in really full, but that's about it. I don't think, you know, the millimeters specifically matter that much. So let's just look at a couple, and I think everyone will agree that, you know, this is pretty much your nearly virtual IVC, and in this case, certainly both views agree. You know, up here we could have what might be more or less normalish, and then this side, when you start seeing the staghorns of the hepatic veins, and this one's getting pretty plump there, or, you know, getting to the 3 centimeter zone, that would be on the full side. I think everyone would agree with that. So there's some pitfalls in looking at it in the long axis, and here's one that I would want to point out. So I did a little Twitter poll, I think in December sometime. I said, all right, so if you look at this, do you think it's fullish, normalish, empty-ish, or really can't tell? And you know, most people thought it was fullish. And you know, based on this, let's say that this is 2 centimeters and more or less is, I would kind of have to agree. I'm not sure what these two, you know, these couple people there, what empty-ish were thinking. But anyhow, then I put up another one and I said, what do you think about this one here? So, you know, people said, yeah, it's fullish, okay. Normalish, okay. Emptyish, okay. And I can't tell. Okay. So can anyone guess what the trick is here? They're both from the same patient. And it just so happens that this IVC here is fairly vertical. Now, most of them are more in an elliptoid kind of fashion. If you've looked at enough short axes, that's how they are. And sometimes you do get the IVCs that are really like a cylinder and they just completely symmetrically collapse down to a tiny cylinder. But this one was kind of the extreme. So if you look at it just in its diameter, and especially if you get a frozen picture that maybe, you know, your resident might have snapshots. Okay, this guy looked full, so I gave him Lasix, now he crashes pressure, it must be something else. But actually, he was more on the, you know, I'd call this a low normal. You could, you know, twist my arm to say that it may be empty, but it's certainly not full. Let's look at some other caveats that can happen. Here's how you get a 100% inspiratory collapse of a 17 millimeter IVC, just because as they breathe, it just pops out of frame. That doesn't happen to you if you look at it in short axis. Here's another one where, conversely, look, there's a less than 50% collapse, right? But in terms of area size, look at that. That's a pretty sizable variation of your IVC. Now, what you're going to do with that information still remains to be seen. But just to kind of make the point that, you know, I think the IVC should be globally looked at. And I think that most of the studies so far that have been done belong in a different kind of filing system in terms of that literature. So I hope there's not too many IVC authors in there. So people are starting to look at it in three dimensions. And I think this was just a couple weeks ago. A study came out looking at your three-dimensional IVC and found that it was, compared to your usual 2D, that it was more more in correspondence with estimating central venous pressure, which obviously it has to be a direct reflection of. So one view is no view. Now, what else? So my two statements here that may be a little bit provocative. The first one is that the IVC is my friend. I love the IVC. I look at it all the time. Almost no day goes by that I'm working that I don't look at a few IVCs. But the corollary to that is even if I look at it a lot, I don't care about volume responsiveness. I really don't, or minimally so. So I've got two great scientists, philosophers here, and he said the most important thing, if you've got an hour to solve a problem, is to really get the right questions to ask. And he had it right, and so did he. You have to ask the right questions. So I agree with both these guys. So what are the right questions when it comes to the IVC? And I think, you know, you guys are all frontline clinicians. I think you can make use of these answers. So my first one is, do I have a massive PE? And IVC will tell you that, that you don't, unless I have a full plethoric IVC, because it's an obstructive shock problem. Doesn't mean you don't have a small one, or even a medium one, or a pretty large one. But is that the one that's killing you on the spot, giving you hypertension? No. Do I have tamponade? Same thing, you might have a pericardial effusion, which you'll look in the next 5 seconds, let's say, but you don't have tamponade if you don't have a fixed plethoric IVC. Same again for attention pneumothorax, becoming repetitive a little bit, I apologize. But again, without your big full IVC, you don't have attention pneumothorax. Should I stop giving fluids? So if I'm getting full, probably should, because I'm probably not volume tolerant, which is what's a lot more important to me than responsive. Do I need to check for venous hypertension? And I think if you're going to follow the POCUS literature, you're going to see a lot more of that come out in the next few years of making sure there's no venous hypertension. And if the IVC is full, you should be looking at that. And how do you look at that? You might look at your hepatic veins. You might look at your hepatic Doppler patterns. You might look at your portal vein. You might look at your renal veins and look for interrupted flow and all kinds of things that, you know, is not really necessarily for today, but are really interesting things to look at. Am I volume depleted? So if I have a really small IVC, you can say maybe, but you do have to look at the rest and make sure it's not just cardiac hyperdynamicity or significant vasodilation, because those things will drop your IVC just as well. Because remember, the IVC is that balance between, you know, between venous return and cardiac output. So, and okay, you can ask, am I volume responsive? And I tend to say if I'm small or mid, you know, with lots of respiratory variation, you're probably volume responsive. But again, it doesn't matter to me too much. Why does it not matter to me too much? Because the problem with is that what do most people do when they have a Schottky patient and they find volume responsiveness? They usually give volume. So if you go on that cycle and you've got your hypotensive patient, you're going, you know, after your liter after liter, 500 after 500, what you end up doing is you end up terminating the fluid responsiveness. And this is a picture of Peter when he was younger. And not the one you think you recognize. So terminating fluid responsiveness is not a great idea, because this is what you end up with. You end up with a whole bunch of consequences of fluid overload. And as just a perspective changer, we have to realize that there is no non-pathological state in which you are not volume responsive. So now there may be some states of non-volume responsiveness that are not, you know, they're not all that bad, and your patient will probably make it. You'll probably diurese them later. But in some patients that may be borderline, maybe have borderline organ dysfunction, it may be some of the engine behind multi-organ dysfunction, and that's a price that some of us will end up seeing up in the ICU at a later time. So I think a lot of that was based on a couple of cognitive paradigms that need to be revisited. And the first is that, and I grew up like that, you know, like leave a fed, leave him dead. You had to give all the fluids that you could in order to avoid giving them pressors. And that paradigm is that fluids are better than pressors, like inherently, they're imbued with goodness. And then that all shock seems to benefit from maximizing cardiac output. And in the literature, you see a lot of that about talks about optimizing and things like that, but that universally ends up being maximizing. And these studies were done in the 80s and 90s with O2 delivery, supernormal O2 delivery, and they all showed that you were just killing patients more by pushing the to, you know, normal or supernormal physiological values. So my take-home messages would be that the IVC is your friend too. You just have to ask it the right questions, and then sometimes less can be more. For any questions now, or here's my email for anyone who might want it. Any questions? Oh, yeah, Patrick. No, because a lot of people say that, well, you can't, you know, the IVC doesn't, because it's just due to the pulmonary hypertension. But, you know, the kidneys and liver and the gut, they don't particularly care why the pressure is elevated. If the congestion is there, the congestion is there. So what you do see a lot, like a lot of times you use these venous hypertension, you know, new paradigms, let's say, to manage cardiorenal syndromes. And what you do find is that with a severe pulmonary hypertension patients where, you know, pressures are starting to get close to systemic arterial pressures, you just have a really narrow margin of maneuver. Like normally you might have, you know, when you have your big full IVC and you've got all signs of venous hypertension in your kidney, renal, venous flows, you can diurese the daylights out of them, like pull liters and liters, and if anything, you improve their blood pressure. But the severe pulmonary hypertension ones, it's really sometimes you take a 1 liter off too much, and now their creatinine that was going down nicely with diuresis starts to rise back up. And the same thing with severe shock patients. They just have a really narrow margin of operation.
So what do you titrate? I mean, what are you exactly titrating? What clinical effect are you trying to get to? Is there a measure you look at, or do you look at respiratory rate, or do you, I mean, what is it you're looking at?
So in which case of patients are you thinking? So you're... Yeah, so if it's a pulmonary hypertension patient, that the cons that I commonly see are the sort of the cardiorenal ones. And then, yeah, you've got to balance that, you know, that the respiratory issues, a little bit of congestion, with trying to find what's their best creatinine kind of thing. And it ends up being a bit of trial and error, because you can't normalize oftentimes their venous hypertension. You can't get it down to the fact that, let's say you wanted, so one of the things that we see is we see pulsatile portal vein flow. And in a straight CHF patient, you can normalize that right off to a nice flat flow. and their creatinine needs to keep improving, and they do really well. But in a pulmonary hypertension patient, you can never quite get them there. You might get them a little less, and then their creatinine that was dropping starts to rise up again, or their blood pressure starts to drop. It's pretty tough. It's essentially ends up, for the severe pulmonary hypertension, it's kind of trial and error of fluid and lysates.